and her children will arise and call her blessed. Mothers come in great variety. They come in a variety of hair color and skin color. They come from different backgrounds and different personalities and different interests. Some are formally educated. Some are informally educated. Some are rich. Some are poor. And most are neither. And mothers can be very different from each other and still be excellent mothers. But there's at least one thing in which they must be alike, or their children and their children's children and the nation and the kingdom of God will suffer. And that one thing in which they must be alike is they must be there. They must be there. Last year, the producer of National Public Radio's Talk of the Nation program invited a Christian to join her and others. Now, this Christian was Catherine Kirsten, and she was invited to join Marie Wilson, the director of the Ms. Foundation, on the program. And they were going to discuss the Take Our Daughters to Work Day that I believe has just recently passed once again. Catherine Kirsten was invited to be on the program because she was a lawyer with an MBA degree who had chosen to become a stay-at-home mother. And during the program, Catherine said she thought that the Take Our Daughters to Work Day was a good idea insofar as it taught our daughters the ideas or the ideals of working hard and aiming high and striving for excellence. But she said it doesn't truly address the most significant issue. That is, the issue that is of major concern to most women. Mothers from all walks of life will voice the same concerns. And that is, I'm scared for my children and the future they are headed into. Women as well as men are troubled by the world into which we are sending our children. How is it that Channel 4, I believe even right now, is describing that? They're doing a program, I think the title of it is Raising G-Rated Children in an X-Rated World. During the public radio program, Catherine asked, who speaks for women like me? Women who, whether they work or not, believe that their primary duty is to their children. Clearly, society's most pressing need at the moment is not for more accountants or lawyers. What we need, she said, is more decent people of the kind only strong families and dedicated parents can produce. We need people of character. We need people who understand the difference between right and wrong. We need people who are committed to the common good. The women I know, Catherine Kirsten said, want their daughters to become such people. She went on to say that as the program went on, I think Marie Wilson of the Ms. Foundation was perplexed by my choice to put my children first. And she was also perplexed by my concept of motherhood as involving moral duties that simply could not be passed off to others. Catherine Kirsten's concern and the concerns of the women she knows are not only their concerns, but they are also the concerns of other men and women, and they are the concerns of a nation, our own nation. Even our Congress is debating these issues today. Secular authors, television programs, whatever the case or whatever the situation or venue, people are discussing this issue of the need for parents to be there. Our children need parents who are there. Now, at other times, I have spoken very pointedly to fathers regarding this issue. This morning, I would like to address myself to the mothers. Dr. Selma Freeberg, in her book entitled Every Child's Birthright, called for an informed citizenry. She has called for a public that wants to protect and wants to advance the rights of every child by considering each child worthy of mothering. She said, the time has come for us to celebrate motherhood, and the time has come in this country for us to recreate an ethic that recognizes the worth and dignity of mothering within our society. We can't afford not to any longer. Susan was 2 years old, and her sister Sandy was 2 months old when their father drowned. when their father drowned. Susan's mother was left with $500 of insurance money. And believing that she could not rear two small children and work full-time, she left the older, Susan, with her grandparents. The mother moved to a nearby town with Sandy, the baby. By the time that Susan was 3 years of age and had attached herself very firmly to her grandparents, her mother reappeared and asked to switch the children, leaving the younger one with the grandparents and taking the older one, Susan, with her. Her mother's rationale was that Sandy was too young to be left at the sitter's day after day because she could not even speak. And since Susan was older and could talk, Susan would be able to share with her mother if anything had gone wrong, because something had gone wrong in Sandy's case. Susan says, "Thus my sister and I were traded, and I was raised as a lonely only child in a small southern town." Susan's mother tried to find sitters for her each day while she worked, but by the time Susan was 7 years of age, she was coming home alone to an empty apartment. Even now, Susan says, "I can remember distinctly the cold fear that enveloped me when I unlocked the door and entered that darkened place. I would check every room, I would check every closet before I would begin to slowly relax. But even when I wasn't afraid, I did not like going into that gloomy place. No voice rang out assuring me it was safe to enter. No mother's arm reached out to give me a hug welcoming me. And when I had been wounded by a teacher or by another child and came home needing attention, no one was there to buttress my sagging self-esteem. And when I came home with good news, there was no one to hear it. When mother worked evenings, I would turn on every light in the apartment and I would position myself in the middle of the living room in such a way that I could see both the front door and the back door of that apartment, fearing burglars. When mother worked days in the summer, I became a street child because companionship for me was out there. It was not in here. Now, like millions of other children, I had accepted the fact that my mother had to work. How else, she would often explain to me, can we possibly live? And the brightest spots of the week for me were when another child would invite me to their home, and I would always say yes if that other home was where a mother was. And those stay-at-home moms profoundly influenced my young life. One, pregnant with her third child, allowed me to touch her swollen abdomen and then taught me the joys of childbirth. When I was a young adolescent, another neighbor introduced me to Jesus, a Jesus who paid her heating bills and rent and food bills on the many occasions when her alcoholic husband would disappear for weeks at a time. And Susan says, "And without a doubt, the best part of my year is when we would go visit my grandparents. Compared to the food that I normally prepared for myself, grandmother's cooking was extraordinary, but far better than the food was the fact that my grandparents were always there. Granny could be found in the house somewhere, or out in the garden, or granddaddy could be found in the barn, or out in the field, and the security that I felt released me to enjoy my time there like nowhere else on earth." As an adult, Susan reflected on those years and said, "When I look back on the years of my mother's care, it would be dishonest if I implied to you that all of the sadness and emptiness that I felt stemmed from the fact that my mother worked. Perhaps it would have been different if we had truly been able to be together for the first 5 or 6 years. Maybe then I could have handled the other absence later." But she says, "As I began to do research and reading on the subject on bonding and a mother's strategic importance to her young children, I began to understand the origin of some of my own feelings of lostness and unlove." I find it amazing that our legislators today are looking for more and more ways to enable families to send their children to daycare instead of looking for ways to enable mothers to stay at home with their children. Tatiana Zaslavskaya, easy for me to say, president of the former Soviet Sociologists Association, just prior to the disintegration of the Soviet Union in 1989, was quoted in TASS. I believe TASS is the official communist paper of the former Soviet Union. And she expressed herself in that paper as having deep concern for all of the ill effects on children of the high rate of employment among working women in their culture. and she pleaded in this communist newspaper for mothers to make children their prime mission, calling on the Communist Party to discuss the ways to reduce the employment rate among mothers. And she added that the problem that is often glamorized in the United States as the superwoman phenomenon, that is, the woman who is faster than a speeding two-year-old, these are her words, a woman who is faster than a speeding two-year-old, able to leap tall laundry piles in a single bound, and possessed of more strength than three teenaged boys, and still able to go out and save the world in the midst of it all. In spite of that problem, that glamorized superwoman phenomenon, that has been known, she said, in the Soviet Union for years as the problem of two jobs. Mikhail Gorbachev, when he was president, right about that same time, said that Russia is now looking for ways to make it possible for women to return to their womanly mission. I find those words absolutely amazing, coming from a culture that for 70 years said, collectivizing everything is the way to go, including childcare. And they took the mothers away from the children and paid the price as a nation. A study of primarily middle-class children was conducted by University of Texas at Dallas researcher Vandell and Corasaniti. The study indicated that when a child was cared for full-time by someone other than his mother, that child had poorer study skills, lower grades, diminished self-esteem, and inadequate social interaction. Those who were away from their mothers full-time, even after the first year of their lives, did not develop as well socially, emotionally, or intellectually as those mothers who stayed at home with them. Now that, folks, that study has been replicated all over this country. And it seems that every time that study, those results come from these studies, the researchers are surprised. And the researchers, in fact, say it doesn't mean what the research shows, somehow trying to move around it. And if we are as concerned as we ought to be about our children's educational and emotional development, then surely we would also want to be concerned about our children's values and about their character, which are determined very, very early in life. I ask you, which will influence a young child more? A worn-out working mother, or 45 or 50 hours in a daycare center? The question is, who is rearing our children? Good lives don't just grow accidentally. They come from people who care. Please do not misunderstand. I'm not suggesting that caregivers other than mothers are somehow always negligent or negative influences on children. There are excellent child caregivers. Nor am I suggesting that every mother who works outside of the home is a poor mother. That is obviously not true. And also, some mothers, unfortunately, have no choice. Nor am I suggesting that every mother is the best caregiver for her own children, because there are, unfortunately, also some unfit mothers. What I am pleading is for mothers to stop so easily giving away the most important calling in their lives, to be mother and to be there. Deborah Evans, in her book, Heart and Home, has written, "Those of us who continue to highly value our roles as wives and mothers are an endangered minority." That's supported by a number of polls that have been done. In 1970, 52% of 1,000 women polled said that motherhood was the most enjoyable aspect of being a woman. 52% of them said motherhood was the most enjoyable aspect of being a woman. By 1983, and I've not seen more recent statistics, but by 1983, that had dropped to 26% of those women. Only 26% of the women found that motherhood was one of the most enjoyable aspects of being a woman. Deborah Evans wrote, "The worth of our work has been eclipsed by the opinion makers of Madison Avenue. For private enterprise gains much from the earnings of working women. Needing a second car in order to get to work? Ford Motor Company and Toyota love it. How about dining out more because there just is not enough time after getting home tired and late? Great. Most restaurants planning on your arrival offer special kids menus and special prices. to make it easier for you. A better wardrobe, improved image, step right up to your closest department store, which counts on your regular patronage. What's happened in our culture is that few families want to give up a second income. Few families are willing to give up all of the possible amenities that a second income makes available. Evans goes on to write, "For those of us who have resisted the pressure to relinquish our beliefs about marriage and the family, what is it that has caused us to remain committed to a dying ideal? Why are we not willing to leave our neighborhoods every morning like everyone else? What is it that's keeping us so close to home? Is it ignorance? Is it laziness? Is it our husband's salaries? Is it the fear of the real world?" "Hardly," she said. "For most of us, I suggest it is due to the fact that we have a different value system. Simply put, our husbands and our children are the most important people in our lives, and we refuse to compromise their well-being by exhausting ourselves for the sake of money or an enlarged identity." She said, "By not having it all, I've settled for something far more precious than another paycheck. I've become the guardian of new life, a builder of memories, a source of inspiration, and a central figure in my family's history. And what I have contributed to their lives is invaluable and irreplaceable." Brenda Hunter was married and in school herself when her firstborn came. Having read Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique when her baby was only 9 years of age, Brenda came to understand her own restlessness at home. She was an educated woman, and she came to understand that she was virtually wasting her mind and her life being a stay-at-home mom. And that did it. Off to work she went. And it helped that her husband was an intern earning only $4,000 a year. They needed the money. And every day as she drove the 15 miles to the college where she taught, she would convince herself that she was different than those stay-at-home moms who lost themselves in coffee clutches and silly games with their babies. She needed to be productive and do something important and useful with her life. Now, she would quickly add that certainly taking care of a child was productive and it gave certain feelings of usefulness, but she could get that in the evenings because her life was larger than that and it had to count for something more than that. And she enjoyed her work immensely, and the salary that she earned allowed her to take lunches out and buy new clothes and have money for vacations. And very importantly, that work outside of the home allowed her to answer that very powerful question put to her by other wives. What do you do? What do you do? But each day as she dropped her daughter Holly off at the daycare center, she would wonder what Holly's day was going to be like. Would there be people there who would truly watch her? Would there be people there who would truly take care of her special needs? Would she develop properly? And each day, Brenda found it difficult to concentrate on her own work because of wondering about her daughter. And after three different daycare centers or three different sitters in 3 months, she became almost fanatical about the kind of caregiver that she wanted for Holly. Now, folks, I want you to hear the irony in all of this. Listen to it carefully. Although she, Brenda, had other tasks that demanded her attention, she wanted to employ someone who would consider care for Holly as her primary responsibility. Furthermore, she wanted this woman to feel a sense of fulfillment in taking care of her daughter, a fulfillment that she did not believe she had for herself. In the area of mothering, she clearly expected from the caregiver what she did not expect from herself. Brenda's husband left her, and then in Brenda's thinking, working full-time was no longer optional. But there was a growing restlessness with her decisions about childcare, and that prompted a change in her life. Brenda said she can remember too vividly a scene that occurred too often. She would drop Holly off at the daycare center, and Holly would go right past her friends out into the playground, climb as high as she could on the fence, and wave at her mother until her mother's car was out of sight. And Brenda said, "Every day as I would drive off to work from that place, I would see my daughter's little face in my rearview mirror. And I knew that she desperately wanted to be with me." Now listen to Brenda's words. "From years of growing, reading, and listening to my daughters, for by then I had two, I have come to see just how much I contribute to their feelings of security and well-being. As I have come to understand my enormous value in their lives, God has deepened my love and my concern for them until I consider child-rearing the most significant work I do. And Brenda changed her life and became a mother who was there. Now, I recognize this morning that my remarks have probably created a fair amount of tension. As I said earlier, I know there are women in this room who, for good reason, have no choice but to be away from their children. But I suspect that with most of them, they desperately long to be with their children. And my criticism is not of those mothers. They would change anything they possibly could to be with them. My plea is to those mothers who have underestimated the importance of mothering, those mothers who are searching for significance in other places, those mothers who have bought the selfish goals of a perverted culture. It's to them I appeal. And in fact, even as I say that, I recognize that my appeal is not simply to those mothers, but it's to an entire culture which has created the dilemma in which we find ourselves, a culture that our politicians and our legislators and the media and everyone else is talking about, a culture in which women feel inferior if they choose mothering over a career, a culture in which husbands abandon their wives and force them to leave their children. I find it interesting that we think we've come a long way if we can get absentee fathers to kick in $250 a month. I don't know how it's possible without changing an entire culture, but folks, when we will finally see the day when a father is responsible not only for $250 or $300 or $500 or $1,000, but responsible to make certain that a mother can be there, then I think we will have arrived. A culture in which husbands pressure their children's mother to get a paying job so the house can be enlarged, so another car can be purchased, so we can take a longer vacation. A culture in which mothers are persuaded to largely abandon the most significant task they could ever possibly undertake so they can purchase carpeting, or new draperies, or dining room furniture. And what has happened is we have a culture that is abandoning its children. My earliest memories are of a farmhouse in rural Wisconsin. I was 5 and my mother was there. I remember the second of the farm homes in which we lived as I was growing up. But frankly, where we lived didn't matter, as most children would say, because home was where my parents were. And my mother was there. My mother worked hard. My parents were farmers and she worked seriously at gardening because that was a source of food for us, and she assisted with the bookkeeping of that business. But in the midst of all of that work, and she worked full-time with all of that, my mother was there. My mother disciplined us seriously but fairly. We knew the boundaries. We were convinced that she had eyes in the back of her head and that she could read our minds, and she could because she was there. Summer or winter, she was there, and coming home for me during the school year was the best part of the day. For whether I'd had difficulty with some subject in school, or whether I'd had a fight with some kid, or whether I was angry at my brother, or whatever, she was there. My mother is 75 years old in about another month. A couple of years ago, my older brother, my two younger sisters, and I and our families were in my parents' church celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary. 26 children and grandchildren stood before them and sang, "May those who come behind us find us faithful, as our parents have been faithful." We stood and sang to honor our father and our mother. And among other reasons, we sang it to honor a mother who had been there. As the author of Proverbs put it, "Her children will arise and call her blessed." Women, if God calls you to be a mother, please be there.